Reading from Srimad Bhagavatam, first canto, chapter 16. How Parikshit received the age of Kali, text number 12. Bhadrasvam ketamalam cha.
Bhadrasvam ketamalam cha.
Bharatam chotaran kurum.
Bharatam chotaran kurum.
Kim purushadini varsani.
Kim purushadini varsani.
Vijitya jagrihe balim.
Vijitya jagrihe balim.
Bhadrasvam.
Bhadrasvam.
Bhadrasva.
Bhadrasva.
Ketumalam.
Ketumalam.
Ketumala.
Ketumala.
Cha.
Cha.
Also.
Also.
Bharatam.
Bharatam.
Bharat.
Bharat.
Cha.
Cha.
End.
End.
Uttaran.
Uttaran.
The northern countries.
The northern countries.
Kurun.
Kurun.
The kingdom of the Kuru dynasty.
The kingdom of the Kuru dynasty.
King Purushadini.
King Purushadini.
A country beyond the northern side of the Himalayas.
A country beyond the northern side of the Himalayas.
Varsani.
Varsani.
Parts of the earth planet.
Parts of the earth planet.
Vijitya.
Vijitya.
Conquering.
Conquering.
Jagrihe.
Jagrihe.
Exacted.
Exacted.
Balim.
Balim.
Strength.
Strength.
Translation. Maharaj Parikshit then conquered all parts of the earthly planet. Bhadrasva, Ketumala, Bharat, the northern Kuru, Kimpurusha, etc., and extracted tributes from their respective rulers. Purport. Bhadrasva is a tract of land near Meru Parvat, and it extends from Gandhamadan Parvat to the saltwater ocean. There's a description of this Varsa in Mahabharat, Bhishma Parva 7:14-18. The description was narrated by Sanjaya to Dhritarashtra. Maharaj Yudhisthira also conquered this Varsa, and thus the province was included within the jurisdiction of his empire. Maharaj Parikshit was formally declared to be the emperor of all lands ruled by his grandfather, but still he had to establish his supremacy while he was out of his capital to extract tributes from such states. Ketumala. This earth planet is divided into seven dvipas by seven oceans, and the central dvipa, called Jambudvip, is divided into nine varsas or parts by eight huge mountains. Bharatvarsa is one of the above mentioned nine varsas, and Ketumala is also described as one of the above varsas. It is said that in Ketumala, women are the most beautiful. This varsa was conquered by Arjuna also. A description of this part of the world is described, is available in the Mahabharat, Sabha 28:6. It is said that this part of the world is situated on the western side of the Meru Parvat, and inhabitants of this province used to live up to 10,000 years, Bhishma Parva 6:31. Human beings living in this part of the globe are of golden color, and the women resemble the angels of heaven. The inhabitants are free from all kinds of diseases and grief. Bharatvarsa. This part of the world is also one of the nine varsas of the Jambudvip. A description of Bharatvarsa is given in the Mahabharat, Bhishma Parva, chapters 9-10. In the centers of Jambudvip is Ilavritavarsa, and south of Ilavritavarsa is Harivarsa. The description of these varsas is given as the Mahabharat, in the Mahabharat, Sabha Parva 28:7, as follows. Nagarams chavanams cheva nadis chavimalu dakaha purusan deva kulpans cha naris chapriya darshinaha adrista purvan subagan sadadrasa tananjaya sadanani sachubrani naris chapsarasam nibaha. It is mentioned here that the women in both these varsas are very beautiful, and some of them are equal to the apsaras, or heavenly women. Uttarakuru. According to the Vedic geography, the northernmost portion of Jambudvipa is Uttarakuru Varsa. It is surrounded by the saltwater ocean from three sides and divided by Sringavan Mountain from the Hiranmaya Varsa. Kimpurusha Varsa. It is stated that to be situated north of the great Himalaya Mountain, which is 80,000 miles in length and height, and which covers 16,000 miles in width. These parts of the world were also conquered by Arjuna. Sabha 28:1-2. The Kimpurushas are descendants of a daughter of Daksha. When Maharaj Yudhisthira performed a horse sacrifice yagya, the inhabitants of these countries were also present to take part in the festival, and they paid tributes to the emperor. This part of the world is called Kimpurusavarsa, or sometimes the Himalayan provinces, Himavati. It is said that Sukadev Goswami was born in these Himalayan provinces and that he came to Bharatvarsa after crossing the Himalayan mountains. In other words, Maharaj Pariksit conquered all the world. He conquered all the continents, adjusting all the seas and oceans in all directions, namely the eastern, western, northern, and southern parts of the world. So here we find a description of geography according to the Vedic model. Not exactly according to modern geographical considerations. Now, if we take the directions that are given here and the Himalayas sort of as a orientation point, then we could start giving we could try to identify these regions that are described here. However, it may not entirely work out. One might conclude that somewhere in Kazakhstan, possibly there might be Kimpurusavarsa, since it is north of the Himalayas. However, that may not be entirely correct. And why is it so? Because although we may fly over the Himalayas, right, and if the sky is clear, we may get an interesting view. We may, as we come up from North India and there are no clouds, then we get like sort of a complete overview over the Himalayas, and we sort of see their limits at one point of the entire range. One can see sometimes. I have seen sometimes. But what we don't see is Mount Meru. No golden mountain somewhere in the center. We don't see. Nor do we see Kimpurusavarsa. We cannot see all the nine divisions of Jambudvip, because actually these divisions are only visible. They are like dimensions. They are like other dimensions, which are not necessarily visible to all of us. Therefore, we come to the Himalayas, and there's more to it than what we are currently seeing. That is the situation. One cannot fully read it like that. Sadaputta Prabhu has made a book based on Vedic cosmology, based on Srimad Bhagavatam, and he has sort of mapped out the universe, and then he explains that Jambudvip, the island of Jambudvip, is not just referring to the earth, but is referring to the earth regions, right? And that's like the middle planetary systems, so to speak, are including Jambudvip. So Jambudvip could be counted as a depiction of the universe. At least a portion of the universe, like that. So whatever may be here in these descriptions of the of geography, it may not completely correspond with modern geography, and we leave it for what it is. At least I will, because I am not qualified in the way Sadaputta was, you know, to try and map out the universe. Not my cup of tea. Exactly the position of the moon in relation to the sun and all these things. Okay. According to Bhagavatam, the moon is further away than the sun, that much we know. But otherwise, these technical aspects of the Bhagavatam are secondary. The essence of the Bhagavatam is simply that in each of these tracts of land there are human inhabitants, but they are not all of the same nature. According to their piety, they've been granted different facilities. Like here we're seeing that human beings that are living in Ketumala, they are of a golden color, and the women resemble the angels of heaven. We have no experience of that. Just as well, may the brahmacharis say, and the sannyasis. But leaving that aside, it's simply an area that is not available to us, is not meant for us. So there are many places where they're described in the Bhagavatam with a human population which are not currently within our reach. And these personalities have different degrees of piety and are described to be in the higher regions, they're all devotees. We find that even areas in the heavenly planets are described to attain, to contain human type of races. Even above in the above the heavenly planets, in the Maharjana and Tapa lokas, human-like creatures, and finally in Brahmaloka also human-like forms. So nothing like the science fiction books that kind of have all these theories about all kinds of extraterrestrial beings. But what about the UFOs and about the greens and the grays and those kind of, like, you know. Yes, they're also described in Bhagavatam as coming from the subterranean heavenly planets. Actually, below planet Earth, there are some planets which are very heavenly. One of them is the planet where who resides? Bali Maharaj, known as Sutala. So Bali Maharaj is residing there, and his planet is described as being more opulent than the heavenly planets. So there are subterranean planetary systems which are more opulent than the Earth planet, but they are there's less God consciousness there. Yeah. So according to one's God consciousness, and that goes hand in hand with not being afflicted by lust, one gets a particular type of body. The more we are afflicted by lust, the lower we are placed in the universe. In the higher regions, they are celibate, and so on. The essence is that is the relationship with Krishna and the awareness of Krishna. It is described that in higher planetary systems, the Kinnaras are residing, and they have bodies with wings, just like Garuda. And when they are flying around, the wings make the sound of the Samaveda. So from their wings, the Samaveda comes. So always one can hear the Samaveda in these planetary systems. All this may sound like a very mythological, but yes, that is, we take it as a fact. We take that as a fact and simply... that modern science is conditioning people to not accept what they cannot see. We're being trained. If you can't see it, then, you know, don't believe it. Be skeptical. That's our modern educational system. Don't just believe everything they tell you. We also say so. They say rely on your senses. What you can see, that is evidence. You know, but we say such evidence is unreliable, because what we see, the eye is distorting so many things, we cannot rely on the eye. But for us, the first and foremost evidence is the Veda, not what we see, but Sabda Brahman, this transcendental knowledge of the Vedas. So based on that, we accept reality. And Srila Prabhupada was very strong in that way. He was able to... He wasn't intimidated by modern science. Rather, he would strike back. And he would strike back with good questions. If there was a big bang, what was the... and there was dense matter, which then began to expand, what was the origin? If at one point... Like now in South Africa, recently in the newspaper, this news about the new species, the missing link, I mean, you know, has been found. There is some sort of species clearly between man and ape, right? And this is clearly confirming that evolution is a fact. We're one step closer to proving that evolution is a reality, and that once from apes, man... you know, evolved. And Prabhupada had a simple question. He said, if man came from monkeys, he said, then why is it not happening now? We have monkeys, we have man, everything is there, so why is it not happening? And it's a very, very good question. If they say millions of years ago this happened, but why is it not happening now? The monkeys are still there. Why are there no in-between species now? Why is there... the evolution should continue. Why did it stop if it once happened? So a very good question. And exposing the whole thing, and it's never addressed. A very unique question. You don't hear that question. Everyone is just, yes, 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 oh, very interesting. You know, I was somewhere, maybe I was on the airport, and I saw a picture somewhere of this man who discovered the skull of this in-between man and monkey creature, and he was kissing the skull on the photo. Yeah, he's thinking like, yeah, you know, he's thinking... he's kissing all the money that he's going to make from this skull. You know, his fame is growing every day. But why are monkeys not turning into men today? That is Prabhupada's question. So Prabhupada was brilliant in that way, would ask these kind of very fundamental questions that expose the whole thing. Yeah, after that, she was, okay. Yeah, good question. Who can answer that? So, when we go looking for questions of that answer the origin of things, there is no satisfactory answer from modern science. That everything would have a material cause. Therefore, it's not convincing. So we stand strong. We stand on strong ground with Srimad Bhagavatam. It's not that we are sort of like, this part of the Bhagavatam, we kind of hide it, you know. I mean, it's like showing a different kind of geography than a modern science. The modern world clearly has established, you know. And we don't talk about this part of the Bhagavatam, because we might look foolish. No, we don't. Prabhupada had no problem in standing up and saying, no, you have no qualification. You have no qualification to enter certain kingdoms. You don't have the adhikar. As simple as that. And just to hold his ground, not like waffle and sort of like start perspiring. Because Prabhupada was by no means intimidated by modern science. So that's important, that we also hold our ground and stand up strong and say, yes, Bhagavatam is a fact. It is Amala Purana. It is spotless. It is spotless. And whatever seems to be different, know it to be distorted. Right? As simple as that. That was Prabhupada. No, they didn't go to the moon. As simple as that. Just based on Bhagavatam. So, such faith must be there in Srimad Bhagavatam. Because the Bhagavatam is the literary incarnation of Krishna. It is the only shelter we have. It's the only way that we get a handle on reality. Reality may be revealed to us from within, by chanting Hare Krishna. Reality can be revealed from within, and one can become aware of things just because Krishna reveals it. So like Haridas Thakur was basically chanting, chanting and chanting and chanting. Still, it is said all knowledge was revealed to Haridas Thakur within the heart, and there are discussions between him and Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, and Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu is saying, Haridas, how can you know all these truths? Right? But the fact is that, so knowledge is not just a matter of intellectual learning. It's not just a matter of degrees and a matter of studying. It is also a matter of purity and knowledge being revealed within the heart. Still, Srimad Bhagavatam systematically gives us a vision of the Absolute Truth and is our access to the Absolute Truth. Therefore, we need to study Srimad Bhagavatam. And Srimad Bhagavatam is not only giving us descriptions of the world, of the creation, and all these things, but Srimad Bhagavatam is also showing how every aspect of the world is related to Krishna. And that is the point. That we start seeing everything in relation to Krishna. That is the aim of the Bhagavatam. And that therefore, the Bhagavatam is thoroughly helping us to see Krishna everywhere, at every moment. How everything has its origin in Krishna. Yes. And all the material elements come from Krishna. All the arrangements are related to Krishna. And every living being has a level of perception according to his karma. Dogs can hear things we cannot hear. We can see things dogs cannot see. Scientists say that dogs cannot see color. Right? They see. They're partially colorblind, according to the. Maybe to an extent, maybe their sense of sight is not as much developed as ours. Right? Maybe, but our sense of smell is not as far. As much developed, nor our sense of sound. They can hear tones that we cannot hear. Yeah. They have a much higher frequency rate and so on. So every species has its own limited perception, and therefore we cannot see living beings in higher regions of the universe. We cannot see the moon as it is, right? The moon is a heavenly planet, and we don't have the senses to see what is happening there. With our gross eyes, we cannot see it. It's not possible. And we can get a telescope, to see further, but it's still limited by the capacity of the eye. We put a magnifying glass, but we still cannot see in these regions. So therefore, modern science, which is based on sense perception, is in principle limited, no matter what. Right? Even if you have Hubble, right, still Hubble telescope is limited. It's just the eye that is perceiving through that telescope. So the limitations of our senses will always be there, and therefore there will be all kinds of levels of reality which are beyond our perception unless they are revealed to us, unless Krishna simply reveals to us. Just as when Krishna revealed the universal form, there were several personalities that could see it. Arjuna, of course, saw. The demigods, to an extent, could see it. Sanjaya, to an extent, could see it. So various people were able to witness that, but many could not see it. So it is like that. Naham pakasa sarvasa yoga maya samavritaha. Krishna covers himself or uncovers himself depending on the state of purity of the person. And I may go, you know, from a hardcore scientific background, that may sound a little bit like, hard to swallow, it sounds like a cop-out. Yeah, but then from a perspective, if you go like from a literary perspective, if you see like not from physics but from a literary perspective, when Shakespeare writes there's more between heaven and earth than you know, Horatio, and so on, then it suddenly becomes an intellectual possibility that there are other realms, other dimensions, and so on. So in this way, we are... Bhagavatam is our anchor in the midst of all these questions, etc. And let me just stick with that. That gives us our perspective. But Bhagavatam doesn't go into endless detail, because that's not the aim of Bhagavatam. It's not the business of Bhagavatam to try and describe every detail of the heavenly planets. Right? When we ask the question, what are the demigods having for breakfast? I mean, like, you know, somaras? Roots of lotus flowers or something like that. We're reading that there are areas where the residents are eating the stems of the stems and roots of lotus flowers, and they stay very young and fresh. And other places, they're drinking the sap of certain fruits, and their whole bodies become full of scent and all these kind of things. Yeah, we can read such things in Bhagavatam. And so you can say all these kind of things. But in detail, we don't know what the demigods have for breakfast. It's not described in the Bhagavatam, because it's not the business of the Bhagavatam to give us endless technical details about the universe and whatever's taking place. The business of the Bhagavatam is to give us an overview of the entire universal arrangement in relation to the Supreme Lord. And that's the essence. How it all exists in relation to the Supreme Lord. How it came about in relation to the Supreme Lord. There is the universal form that manifests, and then the sense of sight is becoming manifest when the eyes of the universal form, the sun and the moon, are there, and then there's the sense of sight for all living beings. And all the elements in the material world are related to the Supreme Lord. So we're looking at the essence to see the Supreme Lord. That's the essence. That's what Bhagavatam is telling us. See the Supreme Lord everywhere. See how he's present in every aspect, in every atom, in every arrangement, Krishna. So one sees Krishna. We see the sun, we see Krishna. We see Krishna behind. Where else can you get so much heat? Yeah, all that energy. Well, suns come into being, they are stars, that are particularly bright, Where did he get that energy, that endless energy from? Waffle, waffle, waffle. No answer. So we see that Krishna is supplying this energy. So one must train the mind to see everything in relation to Krishna and gradually give up this skepticism towards the Bhagavatam. Yeah, too. It's difficult because we bring it with us. We read the Bhagavatam and automatically there is a reflex of skepticism. Got it. Okay. Next page. Yeah. And we are reading. But we're not wholeheartedly believing. Because we're so conditioned by our modern education. But in the Middle Ages, they were equally convinced that the earth was flat. And nowadays, we're not. Although, I was talking the other day, I was in Australia, in a very remote place, in the outback, driving somewhere through like just endless wasteland, flat. And I was quite sure that we were now driving on the edge of the world and that there on the horizon, if you would go over that, it would just go straight over the edge and drop down, that the earth was flat after all. I was quite sure. It may not look flat in Durban, but I tell you. when they said, to Prabhupada, they say the earth is flat. Prabhupada would say, well, it's flat wherever I go. Of course, you can go around the world, it's possible. But on the way, we may miss a few places where we just can't go. So, any questions? Any comments?
Yeah. In terms of reading the Bhagavatam and just accepting and understanding it, is it a practice or? You have to switch
your intelligence, or is it just by
purification
that
one can do it?
Basically, your question is sort of can be summarized in how can we develop full faith in the Bhagavatam? And one can develop full faith in the Bhagavatam by, first of all, by having faith in one who has faith in the Bhagavatam. Right? It's Prabhupada that gives us faith in the Bhagavatam. We would not approach the Bhagavatam with as much faith, if Prabhupada would not have endorsed it so highly. That is the first thing. Prabhupada is the one who has put Bhagavatam forward as the principal literature. Okay, then we approach it in that mood. And yes, then it is a matter of familiarizing ourselves with this knowledge. Some people say, sometimes we hear people say, I picked up Prabhupada's books and I couldn't make any sense of it. Right? Because there was no prior association with this knowledge at all, and it's sort of like never thought of it, never always in the same kind of view of reality, and then suddenly in this kind of a description that's like so such a different realm. Yeah? But if we approach the Bhagavatam gradually over time, and we just are ready to put our modern worldviews a little bit on the shelf by seeing how relative it is. Like in my lecture, I took some time to question some of the convictions that we have in modern times. So when we begin to question the things that are taken for granted nowadays, then we see, well, maybe it's not so much for granted, actually. Maybe all these things are not so sure. All right, then we can approach the Bhagavatam with more faith. You know, in order to develop faith in one thing, you have to give up faith in another. Right? How can we develop faith in the Bhagavatam and at the same time have full faith, you know, in modern physics? It's not possible. Somewhere we have to choose and say no. Somewhere you have to choose, where are you going to put your faith? It's like our Bhakti Sarup Damodar Maharaj was organizing religious conferences, the synthesis between science and religion. Right? And he brought scientists together, and there was this professor, Joseph Weizenbaum, and he gave a presentation in one of these conferences, and he presented that that actually science is a religion. And he was saying that because it says it has its it has its fundamental convictions. It has its canons, its books, its scriptures that sort of underbuild all that. He said, but for long we lacked a deity. Yeah, we lacked a deity. He said, but with computers coming into being, you know, said, yes, now we have a suitable deity in science. Right? So now the whole thing is complete. Right. Now it's complete. So science is just as much based on belief as anything else. And if it's challenged and challenged and challenged, then even the so-called hard evidence is not as hard as it seems to be. And like Suhota Swami wrote a book called Substance and Shadow, and he gets into it in that book in exposing science. And he quotes one philosopher of science. There's something called the philosophy of science, which studies how science thinks and how science changes their train of thought. So it doesn't study scientific conclusions in itself. It just studies how scientists change their way of thinking over time. And this Karl Popper was like an expert in that field. And he said, the thing about science is that it is assuming to establish the truth. Right? He said, but so far it has proven not to be the case. He said, because each time when there was a theory, then it was overthrown by another. So that means it wasn't true after all. Right? Of course, now there's a new approach to science, which is that it's not about the truth anymore. It's about different paradigms. And you just discover unlimited paradigms, and each paradigm has its own application. Isn't that beautiful? So truth is there is nothing like truth, and truth is not at all the issue anymore. It's about paradigms and different paradigms and different applications. Sounds like LSD to me. Sounds like, yes, you can see so many dimensions of reality, right? You can color it this way and that way and experience it this way and that way. But, you know, we stick with Plato, right? Who was basically in an argument. Socrates is in an argument about this multiple paradigm concept of reality, that there's no limit to the different paradigms, and that reality is simply depending on the perceiver. So the man said then, you know, yeah, so basically, you know, like anything can be true. It's just a matter of like your perspective. So Socrates said, like, well, you know, if there are unlimited paradigms and therefore anything can be true, right? Then I say that the absolute truth is true. Then that must be also true within your paradigms, right? So in this way, he used his own argument to defeat him and to point out philosophically that then, logically speaking, if everything was true, that it must also be possible that there is an absolute truth. So an absolute truth makes a lot of sense, right? It makes life, it makes everything very simple. And the that is the nice thing about the Bhagavatam, is that it's complete. It's, see, modern science has basically cut God out of the picture, and with it, it made the whole arrangement of the universe very fearsome, because the universe is then a machine, and there is no mercy in that machine. It's like just a machine, and it can do anything. So, you know, a meteorite can any moment come and smash planet Earth, and, you know, and we're lucky that so far it hasn't happened. Right? So, you know, and so many other things can happen, actually, you know what I'm saying? And all these things are just within the realm of possibility, and if you just look at it like all the things that are possible and everything that can go wrong and possibly can go wrong, you could get into a lot of anxiety, because it just all goes on by laws of nature. And if you really investigate these things, you know, you'd be shocked. You'd be shocked of what possibly can go wrong. Oh my God, you know? And I mean, total anxiety, right? Whereas when there's Krishna behind everything, which is what Bhagavatam is telling us, then it's not only satisfying our intellect, but it is also satisfying the heart. And ultimately, you know, there's a whole picture there, and ultimately there's shelter, and we need shelter, we're looking for shelter, and ultimately there's peace, and there's Krishna. So there's a rational being, a compassionate being behind it all. Whew, that's a relief. You know, it's not that the meteorites are just going to rain down on my head, but actually it's like there's a divine plan behind it. Whew. My God, and the divine being is ultimately compassionate. Whew. That's a relief. The universe is ultimately compassionate. It's ground. It's founded on compassion. Whew. Gosh, I can relax. I don't have to be afraid of the viruses as much as I was before. And all the other things that creep upon you. I was on a German train, and it was someone in front of me, on the other side, seats were opposite each other, someone was reading a newspaper. So his newspaper was sort of in my face. Right? So, and there was an article on the back of what he was reading about germs, and about all the bacteria, the terrible bacteria and diseases that are there in public places. So I was reading it, you know. And they did a test, right? And they were like going to like the obvious things, like the ATM machine, you know, which is touched by everybody, by all these people, right? And like, you know, and they just took like samples of the screen, right, of the ATM machine, and they tested it. And it was incredible, incredible what strands of germs were living on that on the screen of the ATM machine. I mean, you know, you wouldn't dare to touch it without rubber gloves, would you? But, well, what you don't do for money. Yeah? So, in this way, right? All right, you know. But it was a really interesting article, and as reading it, like, you know, as hoping that the guy wouldn't turn over the page. So, but meanwhile, as I was reading it, it was all about public places and all the germs there, and I was in a public place on the train, you know, sort of like, oh God. And after that article, you sort of walk through the train like... And it's like, there's some things you think about. You think about, like, you have these public toilets with, like, a push door with a spring, so you have to touch it, you know, to touch the door. Okay, you can do it with your foot, you know, kick the door with your foot, right? You know, things like that, you know, so you don't... Yeah, so many heavy germs everywhere. You can get totally paranoid, you know what I mean? See germs everywhere. Oh my God, he's breathing. I don't know if in South Africa it gets so cold that you can see the breath of other people. It does in the winter? Yeah. Well, then you see how far it reaches. You're standing in like a public place. Imagine it here in this room, you know. Yeah, all the germs. Someone's sitting next to you and it's like you're inhaling each other's germs. You realize that. You think you have your privacy. Yeah? But not entirely. There are well-known stories about teachers, when they speak, they spit, you know. And you know that in such classes, you don't sit in the first rows. I mean, these are things that are not so often spoken about, but it's a fact, right? And you think you're safe in the back, you know. But did you think of the breath? That's why you see these Chinese people sometimes. Yeah. So anyway, we're living in this world. It's the more you begin to see things like in a mechanistic worldview, the more there's no more sense of protection. Okay. So it's like you're not protected. You know, you gotta just protect yourself. But in the Bhagavatam, we see we're protected. You know, you're not just getting a disease because of some germ. You're getting a disease because you're sinful. You have sinful reactions. And that's why we're susceptible to it. Otherwise, these germs can't do anything to us. It's a fact. Why do the germs get one and not the other? We're all sitting here in the middle of the germs. Let's be frank. We all brought our germs with us, and there were already some germs here. Right? There's a whole culture. This is the Bhagavatam classroom, and this room is used for many things, and people deposit their germs here. Did you think about that? And they fester here, and it's like, you know, and then every day we add some new ones. Yesterday, I put a lot in here, in this room. I was sneezing like a lot yesterday. And it's all in this room. And in that one. And the door was open this morning. Okay, you get the idea. But when we see Krishna behind everything, well, then we know, ultimately, not that we don't make arrangements for our protection, but we know that ultimately also Krishna protects us. In India, you know, when nowadays women... don't have children, okay, then go to a hospital, do this test, you know, like, okay, they identify it, it's the male, the weak semen, you know what I mean, anyway, freeze it, put it in the freezer, right? Like, and some sort of artificial this and that, and test tube babies, you know, and there you go, right? Did it, right? In previous time, in India, we still see ladies in that condition would go and make offerings to deities and like, you know, and look for blessings. Well, and in that way, deal with the problem. So now we deal with it in a mechanistic way, and before we dealt with it by turning to various deities, to superiors. It may seem that sometimes the mechanistic way is very successful, very successful. But ultimately, turning to the Lord is more successful. The sinful person can temporarily protect himself by mechanistic means. Kill the germ. Spray the insect. But it all comes back. Right? In the form of cancer. Because you put all that poison on the food. Right? Yeah, got rid of the insects, but we're also getting rid of ourselves. Killed all the insects. Killed myself also. I mean, so where are we going when through a mechanistic approach we're trying to be in control? It's quite clear. It may seem that we get control for a little while, but then it gets totally out of control. That's the modern world. You see, build up technology, build up technology, build up technology. Ha ha, nature, what can you do to us? Bang, shut you down with technology, 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 technology. We are in control. And now nature strikes back in heavy duty ways. Global warming, the polar bears, we were talking about it the other day, they can swim. And Nevi was saying, I was saying, you know that polar bears can swim. He said, well, yeah, they got to do some more swimming in the future. Yeah. It's a fact. The ice is melting. Yeah. You know, in the future, it may be Chatsworth at sea. Yeah, and be right there on the beach. Yeah. Holland will go underwater. The Cape also, part of the Cape. Yeah, underwater. Maybe your hometown. The land where you were born.
Oh, no.
Yes. So, Bhagavatam makes us rely on Krishna. And ultimately, at the end, that will come out successful. Even although this mechanistic stuff seems to help. And fortunately, you know, you get cancer, but no problem, we give you chemo. And you can live a few more hellish years. Instead of just, you know, well, I'm not so sure if I'm going to take that stuff, if that would happen to me. Sorry, guys. The world will go on without Kadamakan and Swan. Just go to Vrindavan. Okay, finished or more questions? Finished. Okay. Shri Prabhupada ki jai.